So this samadhi, which has just been given, is the best to be practiced on account of its power of suppressing the samskaras. The samskara which will be raised by this sort of concentration will be so powerful that it will hinder the action of the others and hold them in check. Verse 51. By the restraint of even this impression, which obstructs all other impressions, all being restrained, comes the seedless samadhi. You remember that our goal is to perceive the soul itself. We cannot perceive the soul because it has got mingled up with nature, with the mind, with the body. The ignorant man thinks his body is the soul. The learned man thinks his mind is the soul. But both of them are mistaken. What makes the soul get mingled up with all this? Different waves in the chitta rise and cover the soul. We only see a little reflection of the soul through these waves. So, if the wave is one of anger, we see the soul as angry. I am angry, one says. If it is one of love, we see ourselves reflected in that wave and say we are loving. If that wave is one of weakness and the soul is reflected in it, we think we are weak. These various ideas come from these impressions, these samskaras covering the soul. The real nature of the soul is not perceived as long as there is one single wave in the lake of the chitta. This real nature will never be perceived until all the waves have subsided. So, first, Patanjali teaches us the meaning of these waves. Secondly, the best way to repress them. And thirdly, how to make one wave so strong as to suppress all other waves, fire eating fire, as it were. When only one remains, it will be easy to suppress that also. And when that is gone, this samadhi or concentration is called seedless. It leaves nothing, and the soul is manifested just as it is, in its own glory. Then alone we know that the soul is not a compound. It is the only eternal simple in the universe, and as such, it cannot be born, it cannot die. It is immortal, indestructible, the ever-living essence of intelligence. Chapter 2. Concentration. Its Practice. Verse 1. Mortification, study, and surrendering fruits of work to God are called Kriya Yoga. Those samadhis with which we ended our last chapter are very difficult to attain, so we must take them up slowly. The first step, the preliminary step, is called Kriya Yoga. Literally, this means work, working towards yoga. The organs are the horses, the mind is the rein, the intellect is the charioteer, the soul is the rider, and the body is the chariot. The master of the household, the king, the self of man, is sitting in this chariot. If the horses are very strong and do not obey the rein, if the charioteer, the intellect, does not know how to control the horses, then the chariot will come to grief. But if the organs, the horses, are well controlled, and if the rein, the mind, is well held in the hands of the charioteer, the intellect, the chariot reaches the goal. What is meant, therefore, by this mortification? Holding the rein firmly while guiding the body and the organs, not letting them do anything they like, but keeping them both under proper control. Study. What is meant by study in this case? No study of novels or storybooks, but study of those works which teach the liberation of the soul. Then again, this study does not mean controversial studies at all. The yogi is supposed to have finished his period of controversy. He has had enough of that and has become satisfied. He only studies to intensify his convictions. Vada and Siddhanta, these are the two sorts of scriptural knowledge. Vada, the argumentative, and Siddhanta, the decisive. When a man is entirely ignorant, he takes up the first of these, the argumentative fighting and reasoning pro and con, and when he has finished that, he takes up the Siddhanta, the decisive, arriving at a conclusion. Simply arriving at this conclusion will not do. It must be intensified. Books are infinite in number, and time is short. Therefore, the secret of knowledge is to take what is essential. Take that and try to live up to it. There is an old Indian legend that if you place a cup of milk and water before a Rajahamsa, a swan, he will take all the milk and leave the water. In that way, we should take what is of value in knowledge and leave the dross. Intellectual gymnastics are necessary at first. We must not go blindly into anything. The yogi has passed the argumentative stage and has come to a conclusion, which is, like the rocks, immovable. The only thing he now seeks to do is to intensify that conclusion. Do not argue, he says. If one forces arguments upon you, be silent. Do not answer any argument, but go away calmly, because arguments only disturb the mind. The only thing necessary is to train the intellect. What is the use of disturbing it for nothing? The intellect is but a weak instrument and can give us only knowledge limited by the senses. The yogi wants to go beyond the senses. Therefore, intellect is of no use to him. He is certain of this and, therefore, is silent and does not argue. Every argument throws his mind out of balance, creates a disturbance in the citta, and a disturbance is a drawback. Argumentations and searchings of the reason are only by the way. There are much higher things beyond them. The whole of life is not for schoolboy fights and debating societies. Surrendering the fruits of work to God is to take to ourselves neither credit nor blame, but to give up both to the Lord and be at peace. Verse 2. It is for the practice of samadhi and minimizing the pain-bearing obstructions. Most of us make our minds like spoiled children, allowing them to do whatever they want. Therefore, it is necessary that Kriya Yoga should be constantly practiced in order to gain control of the mind and bring it into subjection. The obstructions to yoga arise from lack of control and cause us pain. They can only be removed by denying the mind and holding it in check through the means of Kriya Yoga. Verse 3. The pain-bearing obstructions are ignorance, egoism, attachment, aversion, and clinging to life. These are the five pains, the fivefold tie that binds us down, of which ignorance is the cause, and the other four, its effects. It is the only cause of all our misery. What else can make us miserable? The nature of the soul is eternal bliss. What can make it sorrowful except ignorance, hallucination, delusion? All pain of the soul is simply delusion. Verse 4. Ignorance is the productive field of all these that follow, whether they are dormant, attenuated, overpowered, or expanded. Ignorance is the cause of egoism, attachment, aversion, and clinging to life. These impressions exist in different states. They're sometimes dormant. You often hear the expression, innocent as a baby. Yet, in the baby, may be the state of a demon or of a god, which will come out by degrees. In the yogi, these impressions, the samskaras left by past actions, are attenuated, that is, exist in a very fine state, and he can control them and not allow them to become manifest. Overpowered means that sometimes one set of impressions is held down for a while by those that are stronger, but they come out when that repressing cause is removed. The last state is the expanded, when the samskaras, having helpful surroundings, attain to a great activity, either as good or evil. Verse 5. Ignorance is taking the non-eternal, the impure, the painful, and the non-self for the eternal, the pure, the happy, and the Atman or Self, respectively. All the different sorts of impressions have one source, ignorance. We have first to learn what ignorance is. All of us think, I am the body, and not the self, the pure, the effulgent, the ever-blissful, and that is ignorance. We think of man and see man as body. This is the great delusion. Verse 6. Egoism is the identification of the seer with the instrument of seeing. The seer is really the self, the pure one, the ever-holy, the infinite, the immortal. This is the self of man. And what are the instruments? The chitta or mind stuff, the buddhi or determinative faculty, the manas or mind, and the indriyas or sense organs. These are the instruments for him to see the external world, and the identification of the self with the instruments is what is called the ignorance of egoism. We say, I am the mind, I am thought, I am angry, or I am happy. How can we be angry, and how can we hate? We should identify ourselves with the self that cannot change. If it is unchangeable, how can it be one moment happy and one moment unhappy? It is formless, infinite, omnipresent. What can change it? It is beyond all law. What can affect it? Nothing in the universe can produce an effect on it. Yet, through ignorance, we identify ourselves with the mind stuff and think we feel pleasure or pain. Verse 7. Attachment is that which dwells on pleasure. We find pleasure in certain things, and the mind, like a current, flows towards them. And this following the pleasure center, as it were, is what is called attachment. We are never attached where we do not find pleasure. We find pleasure in very queer things sometimes, but the principle remains. Wherever we find pleasure, there we are attached. Verse 8. Aversion is that which dwells on pain. That which gives us pain, we immediately seek to get away from. Verse 9. flowing through its own nature, and established even in the learned, is the clinging to life. This clinging to life you see manifested in every animal. Upon it, many attempts have been made to build the theory of a future life, because men are so fond of life that they desire a future life also. Of course, it goes without saying that this argument is without much value, but the most curious part of it is that in Western countries, the idea that this clinging to life indicates a possibility of future life applies only to men, but does not include animals. In India, this clinging to life has been one of the arguments to prove past experience and existence. For instance, if it be true that all our knowledge has come from experience, then it is sure that that which we never experienced, we cannot imagine or understand. As soon as chickens are hatched, they begin to pick up food. Many times it has been seen where ducks have been hatched by hens that as soon as they come out of the eggs, they flew to water, and the mother thought they would be drowned. If experience be the only source of knowledge, where did these chickens learn to pick up food, or the ducklings that the water was their natural element? If you say it is instinct, it means nothing. It is simply giving a word, but is no explanation. What is this instinct? We have many instincts in ourselves. For instance, most of you ladies play the piano, and remember when you first learned how carefully you had to put your fingers on the black and the white keys, one after the other. But now, after long years of practice, you can talk with your friends while your fingers play mechanically. It has become instinct. So with every work we do. By practice, it becomes instinct. It becomes automatic. But so far as we know, all the cases which we now regard as automatic are degenerated reason. In the language of the yogi, instinct is involved reason. Discrimination becomes involved and gets to be automatic samskaras. Therefore, it is perfectly logical to think that all we call instinct in this world is simply involved reason. As reason cannot come without experience, all instinct is, therefore, the result of past experience. Chickens feared the hawk, and ducklings loved the water. These are both the results of past experience. Then the question is, whether that experience belongs to a particular soul, or to the body simply, whether this experience which comes to the duck is the duck's forefather's experience or the duck's own experience. Modern scientific men hold that it belongs to the body, but the yogis hold that it is the experience of the mind, transmitted through the body. This is called the theory of reincarnation. We have seen that all our knowledge, whether we call it perception or reason or instinct, must come through that one channel called experience, and all that we now call instinct is the result of past experience degenerated into instinct, and that instinct regenerates into reason again. So on throughout the universe, and upon this has been built one of the chief arguments for reincarnation in India. The recurring experiences of various spheres in course of time produce this clinging to life. That is why the child is instinctively afraid, because the past experience of pain is there in it. Even in the most learned men who know that this body will go and who say, "Never mind, we've had hundreds of bodies, the soul cannot die." Even in them, with all their intellectual convictions, we still find this clinging on to life. Why is this clinging to life? We have seen that it has become instinctive, In the psychological language of the yogis, it has become a samskara. The samskaras, fine and hidden, are sleeping in the chitta. All this past experience of death, all that which we call instinct, is experience become subconscious. It lives in the chitta and is not inactive, but is working underneath. The chitta vrittis, the mind waves, which are gross, we can appreciate and feel. They can be more easily controlled. But what about the finer instincts? How can they be controlled? When I am angry, my whole mind becomes a huge wave of anger. I feel it, see it, handle it, can easily manipulate it, can fight with it, but I shall not succeed perfectly in the fight until I can get down below to its causes. A man says something very harsh to me, and I begin to feel that I'm getting heated. And he goes on till I'm perfectly angry and forget myself, identify myself with anger. When he first began to abuse me, I thought, I am going to be angry. Anger was one thing, and I was another. But when I became angry, I was anger. These feelings have to be controlled in the germ, the root, in their fine forms, before even we have become conscious that they are acting on us. With the vast majority of mankind, the fine states of these passions are not even known, the states in which they emerge from subconsciousness. When a bubble is rising from the bottom of the lake, we do not see it, nor even when it is nearly come to the surface. It is only when it bursts and makes a ripple that we know it is there. We shall only be successful in grappling with the waves when we can get hold of them in their fine causes. And until you can get hold of them and subdue them before they become gross, there is no hope of conquering any passion perfectly. To control our passions, we have to control them at their very roots. Then alone shall we be able to burn out their very seeds. As fried seeds thrown into the ground will never come up, so these passions will never arise. Verse 10. The fine samskaras are to be conquered by resolving them into their causal state. Samskaras are the subtle impressions that manifest themselves into gross forms later on. How are these fine samskaras to be controlled? By resolving the effect into its cause. When the citta, which is an effect, is resolved into its cause, asmita, or egoism, then only the fine impressions die along with it. Meditation cannot destroy these. Verse 11. By meditation, their gross modifications are to be rejected. Meditation is one of the great means of controlling the rising of these waves. By meditation, you can make the mind subdue these waves, and if you go on practicing meditation for days and months and years, until it has become a habit, until it will come in spite of yourself, anger and hatred will be controlled and checked. Verse 12. The receptacle of works has its root in these pain-bearing obstructions, and their experience is in this visible life, or in the unseen life. By the receptacle of works is meant the sum total of samskaras, or impressions. Whatever work we do, the mind is thrown into a wave, and after the work is finished, we think the wave is gone. No, it has only become fine, but it is still there. When we try to remember the work, it comes up again and becomes a wave. So it was there. If not, there would not have been memory. Thus, every action, every thought, good or bad, just goes down and becomes fine, and is there stored up. Both happy and unhappy thoughts are called pain-bearing obstructions, because according to the yogis, they, in the long run, bring pain. All happiness which comes from the senses will eventually bring pain. All enjoyment will make us thirst for more, and that brings pain as its result. There is no limit to man's desires. He goes on desiring, and when he comes to a point where desire cannot be fulfilled, the result is pain. Therefore, the yogis regard the sum total of the impressions, good or evil, as pain-bearing obstructions. They obstruct the way to freedom of the soul. It is the same with the samskaras, the fine roots of all our works. They are the causes which will again bring effects, either in this life or in the lives to come. In exceptional cases, when these samskaras are very strong, they bear fruit quickly. Exceptional acts of wickedness or of goodness bring their fruits even in this life. The yogis hold that men who are able to acquire a tremendous power of good samskaras do not have to die, but even in this life can change their bodies into god bodies. There are several such cases mentioned by the yogis in their books. These men change the very material of their bodies. They rearrange the molecules in such fashion that they have no more sickness, and what we call death does not come to them. Why should not this be? The physiological meaning of food is assimilation of energy from the sun. The energy has reached the plant is eaten by an animal, and the animal by man. The science of it is that we take so much energy from the sun and make it part of ourselves. That being the case, why should there be only one way of assimilating energy? The plant's way is not the same as ours. The earth's process of assimilating energy differs from our own. But all assimilate energy in some form or other. The yogis say that they are able to assimilate energy by the power of the mind alone, that they can draw in as much of it as they desire without recourse to the ordinary methods. As a spider makes its web out of its own substance and becomes bound in it and cannot go anywhere except along the lines of that web, so we have projected out of our own substance this network called the nerves, and we cannot work except through the channels of those nerves. The yogi says, we need not be bound by that. Similarly, we can send electricity to any part of the world, but we have to send it by means of wires. Nature can send a vast mass of electricity without any wires at all. Why cannot we do the same? We can send mental electricity. What we call mind is very much the same as electricity. It is clear that this nerve fluid has some amount of electricity because it is polarized and it answers all electrical directions. We can only send our electricity through these nerve channels. Why not send the mental electricity without this aid? The yogis say it is perfectly possible and practicable, and that when you can do that, you will work all over the universe. You will be able to work with any body, anywhere, without the help of the nervous system. When the soul is acting through these channels, we say a man is living, and when these cease to work, a man is said to be dead. But when a man is able to act either with or without these channels, birth and death will have no meaning for him. All the bodies in the universe are made up of tanmatras. Their difference lies in the arrangement of the latter. If you are the arranger, you can arrange a body in one way or another. Who makes up this body but you? Who eats the food? If another ate the food for you, you would not live long. Who makes the blood out of food? You, certainly. Who purifies the blood and sends it through the veins? You. We are the masters of the body, and we live in it. Only, we have lost the knowledge of how to rejuvenate it. We have become automatic, degenerate. We have forgotten the process of arranging its molecules. So, what we do automatically has to be done knowingly. We are the masters, and we have to regulate that arrangement. And as soon as we can do that, we shall be able to rejuvenate just as we like, and then we shall have neither birth, nor disease, nor death. Verse 13. The root being there, the fruition comes in the form of species, life, and experience of pleasure and pain. The roots, the causes, the samskaras, being there, they manifest and form the effects. The cause, dying down, becomes the effect. The effect, getting subtler, becomes the cause of the next effect. A tree bears a seed, which becomes the cause of another tree, and so on. All our works now are the effects of past samskaras. Again, these works becoming samskaras will be the causes of future actions, and thus we go on. So, this aphorism says that the cause being there, the fruit must come in the form of species of beings. One will be a man, another an angel, another an animal, another a demon. Then there are different effects of karma in life. One man lives 50 years, another 100, another dies in 2 years and never attains maturity. All these differences in life are regulated by past karma. One man is born, as it were, for pleasure. If he buries himself in a forest, pleasure will follow him there. Another man, wherever he goes, is followed by pain. Everything becomes painful for him. It is the result of their own past. According to the philosophy of the yogis, all virtuous actions bring pleasure, and all vicious actions bring pain. Any man who does wicked deeds is sure to reap their fruit in the form of pain. Verse 14. They bear fruit as pleasure or pain, caused by virtue or vice. Verse 15. To the discriminating, all is painful on account of everything bringing pain, either as consequence, or as anticipation of loss of happiness, or as fresh craving arising from impressions of happiness, and also as counteraction of qualities. The yogis say that the man who has discriminating powers, the man of good sense, sees through all that are called pleasure and pain, and knows that they come to all, and that one follows and melts into the other. He sees that men follow a dream all their lives, and never succeed in fulfilling their desires. The great king Yudhishthira once said that the most wonderful thing in life is that every moment we see people dying around us, and yet we think we shall never die. Surrounded by fools on every side, We think we are the only exceptions, the only learned men. Surrounded by all sorts of experiences of fickleness, we think our love is the only lasting love. How can that be? Even love is selfish, and a yogi says that in the end we shall find that even the love of husbands and wives and children and friends slowly decays. Decadence seizes everything in this life. It is only when everything, even love, fails that with a flash man finds out how vain, how dreamlike is this world. Then he catches a glimpse of vairagya, renunciation, catches a glimpse of the beyond. It is only by giving up this world that the other comes, never through holding on to this one. Never yet was there a great soul who had not to reject sense pleasures and enjoyments to acquire his greatness. The cause of misery is the clash between the different forces of nature, one dragging one way and another dragging another, rendering permanent happiness impossible. Verse 16. The misery which is not yet come is to be avoided. Some karma we have worked out already. Some we are working out now in the present, and some are waiting to bear fruit in the future. The first kind is past and gone. The second we will have to work out, and it is only that which is waiting to bear fruit in the future that we can conquer and control, towards which end all our forces should be directed. This is what Patanjali means when he says that samskaras are to be controlled by resolving them into their causal state in verse 10. Verse 17. The cause of that which is to be avoided is the junction of the seer and the seen. Who is the seer? The self of man, the Purusha. What is the seen? The whole of nature, beginning with the mind down to gross matter. All pleasure and pain arise from the junction between this Purusha and the mind. The Purusha, you must remember, according to this philosophy, is pure. When joined to nature, it appears to feel pleasure or pain by reflection. Verse 18. The experienced is composed of elements and organs, is of the nature of illumination, action, and inertia, and is for the purpose of experience and release of the experiencer. The experienced, that is, nature, is composed of elements and organs. The elements, gross and fine, which compose the whole of nature, and the organs of the senses, mind, etc., and is of the nature of illumination, sattva, action, or rajas, and inertia, tamas. What is the purpose of the whole of nature? That the Purusha may gain experience. The Purusha has, as it were, forgotten its mighty, godly nature. There is a story that the king of the gods, Indra, once became a pig, wallowing in mire. He had a she-pig and a lot of baby pigs and was very happy. Then some gods saw his plight and came to him and told him, "You are the king of the gods. You have all the gods under your command. Why are you here?" But Indra said, "Never mind. I am all right here. I do not care for heaven while I have this sow and these little pigs." The poor gods were at their wits' end. After a time, they decided to slay all the pigs one after another. When all were dead, Indra began to weep and mourn. Then the gods ripped his pig body open, and he came out of it and began to laugh when he realized what a hideous dream he had had. He, the king of the gods, to have become a pig and to think that that pig life was the only life? Not only so, but to have wanted the whole universe to come into the pig life? The Purusha, when it identifies itself with nature, forgets that it is pure and infinite. The Purusha does not love. It is love itself. It does not exist. It is existence itself. The soul does not know. It is knowledge itself. It is a mistake to say the soul loves, exists, or knows. Love, existence, and knowledge are not the qualities of the Purusha, but its essence. When they get reflected upon something, you may call them the qualities of that something. They are not the qualities, but the essence of the Purusha, the great Atman, the infinite being, without birth or death, established in its own glory. It appears to have become so degenerate that if you approach to tell it, you are not a pig, it begins to squeal and bite. Thus is it with us all in this Maya, this dream world, where it is all misery, weeping and crying, where a few golden balls are rolled and the world scrambles after them. You were never bound by laws. Nature never had a bond for you. That is what the yogi tells you. Have patience to learn it. And the yogi shows how by junction with nature and identifying itself with the mind and the world, the Purusha thinks itself miserable. Then the yogi goes on to show you that the way out is through experience. You have to get all this experience, but finish it quickly. We have placed ourselves in this net and will have to get out. We have got ourselves caught in the trap, and we will have to work out our freedom. So get this experience of husbands and wives and friends and little loves. You will get through them safely if you never forget what you really are. Never forget this is only a momentary state, and that we have to pass through it. Experience is the one great teacher. Experience of pleasure and pain. But no, it is only experience. It leads step by step to that state where all things become small and the Purusha so great that the whole universe seems as a drop in the ocean and falls off by its own nothingness. We have to go through different experiences, but let us never forget the ideal. Verse 19. The states of the qualities are the defined, the undefined, the indicated only, and the signless. The system of yoga is built entirely on the philosophy of the Samkhyas, as I told you before, and here again I shall remind you of the cosmology of the Samkhya philosophy. According to the Samkhyas, nature is both the material and the efficient cause of the universe. In nature, there are three sorts of materials, the sattva, the rajas, and the tamas. The tamas material is all that is dark, all that is ignorant and heavy. The rajas is activity. The sattva is calmness, light. Nature, before creation, is called by them avyakta, undefined or indiscrete, that is, in which there is no distinction of form or name, a state in which these three materials are held in perfect balance. Then the balance is disturbed, the three materials begin to mingle in various fashions, and the result is the universe. In every man, also, these three materials exist. When the sattva material prevails, knowledge comes. When rajas, activity. And when tamas, darkness, lassitude, idleness, and ignorance. According to the Samkhya theory, the highest manifestation of nature, consisting of the three materials, is what they call mahat, or intelligence, universal intelligence, of which each human intellect is a part. In the Samkhya psychology, there is a sharp distinction between manas, the mind function, and the function of the buddhi, or intellect. The mind function is simply to collect and carry impressions and present them to the buddhi, the individual mahat, which determines upon it. Out of mahat comes egoism, out of which again come the fine materials. The fine materials combine and become the gross materials outside, the external universe.